Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sustainability as Strategy, a podcast brought to you by the experts at Roland Berger Americas. I'm your host, Sean McMahon, and today I'm joined by Chris Milliken, a senior partner in the regulatory and infrastructure practice focused on power and utilities at Roland Berger. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm great. It's been an eventful week. Very excited to be discussing some of the new reality with you today.
Yeah, you mentioned new reality. And when we first started planning this episode, we were going to be talking about what utilities are doing to tackle sustainability. And I promise we'll get to that. But there's been some things in the headlines lately that I think we want to lead off with some of those topics. And of course, I'm talking about the One Big Beautiful Bill recently passed by Congress and signed by President Trump. So Chris, how is the passage of this new bill reshaping the landscape for utilities?
Well, it's exciting and daunting at the same time. I mean, I think that the impact of the bill is still being digested and understood. We're likely to see it work through utility planning over the next several months. You know, the impact is fairly significant. I mean, if you think about the primary impacts, I would say that the acceleration of the closure of the tax credits for renewables is going to be the number one effect. And then the impact of the foreign entity of concern stipulations in order to qualify for credits is going to have a significant impact both on renewables and on storage. In terms of specific impact, if you want to qualify for the credits, you need to have your plants in service by the end of 27 at the latest. You have to have begun construction by a year from the bill signature. So that puts you at July 4th, 26. In terms of the impact of the foreign entity of concern stipulations, it's kind of a complex calculation, but the idea is to basically disallow credits for any projects that use too much equipment sourced from a prohibited foreign entity. So that list is, you know, complete when you consider China, Russia, and Iran, you know, but the real true impact is focused around Chinese manufactured goods. So the, you know, if you talk about the specifics, it basically says that starting for projects constructed in 26, you got to have at least 40% of your materials coming from non-Chinese influenced entities. And that increases to 26 for 2030 and beyond. And that's true for all the generation incentives. And then when you look at storage, that ratio starts at 55% and goes to 75% by 2030. So this is, it's going to have a meaningful impact on renewables. It's going to have a meaningful impact on storage costs. You know, I think on the supply chain side of the picture, given that storage credits remain in place with the existing IRA sunsetting timing, it's really going to be restructuring those supply chains in order to meet the need for storage. So what does that mean? It means that, you know, basically all of these workarounds that have been achieved in Southeast Asia and elsewhere, they're going to be scrutinized by a very empowered Treasury Department in order to determine whether or not, you know, they are foreign influenced entities. So foreign influenced entities, you know, you're really looking at board membership, ownership, effective control, which is defined by, you know, the contracts that company has with Chinese entities for IP or for product. So it's fairly complex on the FEOC side. It's easy to wrap your head around in terms of the sunsetting of the credits for solar and wind, but it's going to have a really massive impact on renewables and on storage over the next several years. It's not all bad news. There are some good elements in this. You know, we were able to retain the transferability of credits, which was really fundamental to utility ownership of renewables and storage. And there was at least originally conceived an excise tax that would amplify the impact of the FEOC restrictions, was stripped out of the final bill.
Yeah, I remember that excise tax was kind of a surprise that was inserted in there. And a lot of folks were thinking maybe it was just a negotiating chip that they were able to kind of just peel away. I want to get back to, you know, sources of renewable generation. You mentioned how on the storage front, some of these changes are going to have a pretty significant impact. Within sectors like wind or solar, who do you see making out the best, I guess, if we could call it that, and who's going to get hit the hardest?
Yeah, I would say that on wind and solar, you know, the impact is going to be more broadly felt such that, you know, you're really not going to have winners or losers. the step down of the credits is the primary driver there. And what does it mean? It means that at least in one evaluation of the impact saw that any wind that's not currently under development, you can basically consider dead. And then solar, you would basically expect that we're talking about maybe a, you know, more than 100 gigawatts negative impact on the build between now and, you know, 10 years from now. So in terms of winners and losers, I think it's probably better to look at storage. And, you know, I would say that American companies that have been focused on long duration energy storage, LG with some of their battery plans in the United States, they're likely to be winners. You know, I'd also say that in Southeast Asia, to the extent that some of these existing entities can separate themselves from, you know, the Chinese sources of product, components of capital that they've historically been tied to, you know, that they do have the natural cost advantage and as such, you know, would expect that they can grow. However, you know, we also have the domestic content incentives, which are still in place. So it's hard to say beyond storage that there's really going to be meaningful winners in the United States. I think LG has been highlighted as someone that's positioned well to grow capacity in the United States to meet the storage need.
Okay. And then, so like I said at the top, we're here to kind of talk about how these policy changes impact sustainability efforts for utilities. So what are you seeing there from the big picture? And then, you know, after that, I kind of want to get into, you know, conversations about artificial intelligence and the you know, demand on our grid that that's driving. So how are utilities handling that piece of it?
Yeah, I would say that they're still digesting the impact, but, you know, to the extent that integrated utilities that own generation have prepared integrated resource plans that had a meaningful element of renewables and storage in it, they're reassessing the affordability impact of those resources. They're going to have to contemplate additional and new resources in order to meet that need. So in terms of their options that are available to them, I mean, it's a really challenging environment. So you think about the backdrop of load growth and the reality of increasing costs and challenging supply chains for renewables and for storage. And you then quickly turn to gas-fired generation, which is not a sustainability answer, but is ultimately a resource adequacy solution and, you know, a really important arrow in your quiver in order to meet the AI demand growth. And I think what they're realizing is that, you know, that well is only so deep. You know, outside of a few utilities that have done a nice job of kind of locking up supply associated with their IRP. You know, Duke is an example. They've got something, you know, north of 2 gigawatts of turbine capacity from GE Vernova that's been locked up. If they need to go back to that well, I think what they're going to find is that, you know, the available slots in that manufacturing calendar are pretty much tied up for the next 5 years. So it's going to be challenging there. You know, when you think about shorter term, I would say that the reality is we're probably talking about delays of retirements. We're probably talking about uprates at existing plants, nuclear, gas-fired generation, figuring out a way to squeeze more megawatts out of your existing facilities. It really gets more interesting when you talk about the medium term and the longer term. And I'd say that, you know, nuclear is one bright spot in the policy, where both in terms of the tax credits, which they're going to honor the IRA sunsetting timing for the credits that are there. And then there's been some meaningful executive order activity that's supportive of advanced nuclear development, specifically some changes in terms of how the NRC operates and is formed. There's some significant reform considerations there that should speed up licensing of new nuclear technologies and new nuclear assets. There also is a meaningful commitment from the DOE to help with demonstration plants and the desire to utilize existing DOD sites in order to build some nuclear plants that can basically get some of these SMR and advanced nuclear concepts in the field and trialed. So there's going to be there's going to be a lot of focus on nuclear as a result of the OBBBA. You know, I would say that, you know, the door is still open for geothermal and for carbon capture and storage. Credits are still planned as they were originally planned in the IRA with the FEOC conditions that I described earlier. So I think there's a real going back to the drawing board for utilities, for integrated utilities, as they consider what they should be doing around supply planning.
Okay, so it sounds like there might be some near-term, you know, power supply issues when it comes to meeting this huge demand from AI. That sounds like what you're saying in terms of the natural gas might not be ready to come online with a turbine, kind of a supply chain shortage. Nuclear is a little farther down the road. So AI is coming. You know, the data centers are being built. They're on the way. So what are utilities going to do?
It's a great question. And I think you're really keying on what I would say is the, you know, the most critical challenge for utilities and for merchant generators in the next 10 years, which is how do we meet this, you know, this load growth expectation for in order to kind of win the battle for AI. And, you know, when you talk about the numbers, it's really staggering. And in ERCOT, for example, there's an expectation that, you know, load will grow from around 90 gigawatts to 150 by 2031 in the next 5 years. PJM has comparable growth. And I would say that despite the fact that some people are calling into question the reality of those forecasts, you know, there's demonstration of double counting in those forecasts of developers chasing the same opportunity. You know, there's the reality that chip supply could constrain exactly how many data centers get developed right now. You know, the forecasts basically imply that we would secure 90% of the global chip supply through 2030. Despite that, I mean, I think the constraint is real, and it's a kind of a multi-factor constraint. I think that, you know, most immediate constraint, which is a bit more localized, is interconnection capacity, transmission capacity. You quickly move from that to resource adequacy challenges, which is what you just highlighted. You know, if we end up adding tens of gigawatts in Texas and in PJM, I think the reality is we will struggle to meet that need. And then there's the constraint around chip availability, for example. So utilities have a role to play in both of the challenges related to transmission capacity, but also in terms of resource adequacy. So, you know, I think that some utilities are better positioned to interconnect data centers today. They've got ample transmission capacity. You know, there are winners and losers in that perspective. You've got states and PJM utilities that are announcing, you know, more than 10 gigawatts of additions in the next several years. And then there are others that, you know, are already full, right? And there's meaningful transmission upgrades required in order to continue integrating data centers. You know, the reality is utilities have to improve their game as it relates to coordinating with system operators, with the hyperscalers, as they think about, you know, really optimizing the location and timing of those data center additions. You know, that's one way in which they can help with the, you know, the most immediate constraint around transmission capacity. On resource adequacy, I would say that, you know, you've got integrated utilities that have to pull every available lever. I mean, they have to be thinking about, in light of the constraint that we just discussed, how can they really be focused on nuclear in the medium and long term? How can they be focused on securing their supply chain for turbines in the short to medium term? They need to be looking at geothermal. They really need to be coordinating more effectively with hyperscalers, coordinating more effectively with other utilities. I mean, some good examples, you know, I already mentioned the Duke deal with GE Vernova to secure supply of gas turbines. But on you know, I think another example of effective coordination between a utility and a hyperscaler is Entergy's deal with Meta in Richland Parish. You know, they've announced a new massive data center, three new CCGTs, about 2.3 gigawatts in capacity. And Meta is going to help out with some investment around carbon capture and storage and some new solar and storage, battery storage. On the nuclear side, you know, we really need to advance the demonstration of these new technologies. And you see partnerships like TVA working with Ontario on OPG, working with Duke and AEP to get to access DOE money in order to, you know, develop a new GE Hitachi BRXW300. It's going to take work across a number of different fronts in order to meet the needs associated with the load growth from data centers. Other levers that we haven't talked about, I mean, demand side management is going to need to be a focus for T&D focused utilities. How can they contribute, especially as you think about peak shifting on demand response, as you think about energy efficiency, there's going to be some real opportunities there. You know, the reality is in some geographies, utilities are saying that they can play a role in meeting the resource adequacy needs by stepping back into ownership of generation. In Ohio and Pennsylvania, both, there's been discussion. So it's an enormous challenge. It's going to require great coordination between the sources of the new load, primarily the hyperscalers, the utilities, the system operators, and it's not an easy problem to solve. So really need to push on all fronts.
So you mentioned the interconnection queues and how, you know, anyone who covers this industry knows those have been kind of a challenge for a long time, and the wait to get connected can be lengthy. What's the realistic potential of some of these hyperscalers just building out their own generation facilities on site and, you know, just kind of bypassing the grid altogether? I mean, we hear about that, you know, some of the big tech companies trying to do that. Is that something that's going to be, you know, kind of rare? Is it going to be common? You know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think co-location broadly defined is a reality, right? So, you know, between Three Mile Island and Susquehanna, when we talk about existing or retired nuclear plants, siting data centers behind the meter or in front of the meter with some kind of a PPA, that is definitely a strategy that is emerging. And you know, I think every IPP that has merchant nuclear generation is evaluating opportunities for those types of deals. You know, we have experience with the hyperscalers and a fairly deep understanding. They are aggressively looking to understand their options as it relates to developing new generation. I would say that, you know, in the near to medium term, they're going to face a lot of the same challenges that the utilities and the merchants are going to face in terms of turbine availability. You know, their priorities right now is kind of speed to reliable power, right? Green is kind of a secondary priority, and last on the list is cost. But the reality of the supply chain is the reality of the supply chain. So to the extent that they have not already locked in production slots with the turbine manufacturers, it's going to be a challenge for them to get access. But at the same time, you know, they're advancing dialogue with SMR technology companies on the nuclear front. They are evaluating and in some cases making meaningful investments to geothermal. And they're also looking at storage and CCUS as evidenced by the Entergy deal I highlighted. So I believe that co-location will be an element of this, and the hyperscalers have the bankroll and the talent in order to push against it. I just would like to recognize that the supply chain realities are kind of hard to deny.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. Even if you had deep pockets, if there's nothing for you to buy, yeah. you're kind of stuck. You mentioned IRPs, you know, and I want to get back to that for a second, the integrated resource plans that, you know, utilities put a lot of time and effort into crafting these plans, and all these changes we've been talking about so far in this conversation have to have a dramatic impact on some of these plans that these utilities have put together in the past couple of years. And I know the OBBA just passed a week ago, but is it too soon for utilities to be adjusting their IRPs? You know, how long does that take? You know, what are you hearing on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is early days to understand exactly how it will play out. What we can say with certainty is that they will have to be reevaluated. So in light of a, you know, massive change in cost expectations and a ton of affordability pressure from regulators, I do believe that, you know, a lot of the IRPs will have to be reevaluated. You know, in some cases, the front end of that IRP is, you know, plants are already in development. They're going to qualify for tax credits. The FEOC is no concern because of timing or because of supply chain. And those assets will be built. But I do think when you look in the medium to longer term, there's going to have to be a reassessment of the resources that are in that plan. It kind of butts up against targeted sustainability objectives at kind of the state policy level. And that's where, you know, there's going to have to be a dialogue between the utilities, the regulators, the policymakers around, okay, what does our existing expectations imply in terms of share of wallet impact to our ratepayers? And are we willing to accept that? And if we're not, you know, what are alternative scenarios? How do we think about potentially adjusting our objectives in light of that affordability concern? So it's going to happen. It will happen in some cases relatively quickly, you know, based upon proceedings that are already in place and regulatory calendars that will force it. But yeah, I think there's going to be some hard reckonings in states that have aggressive decarbonization objectives, just as they recognize that, you know, their customers ultimately won't be able to afford power because of the impact of, you know, and the realities of offshore wind not showing up in the way that people were anticipating in the Northeast. There's just been a lot of changes in the last year, OBBBA being the, you know, most significant and most recent. But yeah, I do think a reforming of those IRPs and a reckoning as it relates to policy is coming.
Okay, so we've talked about the impact that the OBBA is having on, you know, how utilities are approaching sustainability and also how they're going to try and navigate, you know, load growth and managing all that. But let's shift to internal operations. You know, how are utilities prioritizing sustainability in their own operations and on the day-to-day front?
Yeah, I think there's easy answers to that, and there's some more complex answers. So, you know, it's very easy to point at utilities' commitments as it relates to decarbonizing their non-generation operations. So, you know, most utilities have committed to electrification of their vehicle fleets, you know, looking at kind of their sources of power for their facilities and securing renewable power for that, green power for that. So that's kind of a simple, fairly consistent answer. We've spent a lot of time talking about their generation portfolios for integrated utilities. And, you know, I would say that that's going to be the exercise over the next several years is figuring out how to accomplish, you know, your sustainability objectives in light of supply chain challenges, load growth, and policy changes. But I think we've covered that adequately. You know, there's another lens on this, you know, for utilities that also own gas LDCs, I would say that, you know, the environment's changing pretty rapidly, similar to the electric side. You know, and I think it's like a third of states where you have a future of gas proceeding. And most of the more progressive states, there's a desire to shift away from natural gas use and to limit the investment in those gas systems. It's a tricky thing to do because, you know, we've talked a lot about data centers and load growth. And so if we're talking about changing heating to heat pumps, it's another source of load growth that, you know, they may struggle to meet, but it is a reality. So, you know, I'd say that the responsible utilities that I work with are very focused on, you know, the methane gas emissions from their systems. So they're evaluating their systems for leak-prone pipe and proposing replacements, executing replacements in order to minimize those methane emissions. And as you think about the longer term, I would say that, you know, tighter planning and coordination between utilities on the gas and electric side is going to be key. You know, you really need to ensure that electric grid is in place and is reliable before you start switching over from gas to electric heating. You know, my perspective, or many of our clients, you know, acknowledge the objective and are really pushing for what I would call a managed transition, where you're really sectionalizing the, you know, the gas system and thinking about ways to electrify in certain pockets. You know, the affordability lens on this is pretty significant. If you can shut down portions of the gas system over time, it does allow you to avoid a lot of capital. So I would say that on the gas side, there's plenty of progress. You know, another thing they're doing in their operations in order to drive sustainability is really continuing to push on interconnection of renewables and on transmission planning. I mean, I'd say that there's been some bright spots in terms of utilities coordinating with system operators to, to really define corridors for renewable interconnection and helping provide visibility to developers of renewables to like, okay, here are the places where we can feasibly interconnect renewables on the right timeline and at the right cost. I'd say that a good example recently of a utility action to influence that is in Texas, the plan for the strategic transmission expansion plan. It's all about basically adding a lot of capacity between the load centers in the east and the areas of renewables development and where a lot of data centers are going in the west. And you know, the plan was considering alternatives, 345 kV versus 765 kV transmission build out. Utilities advocated for the 765 kV solution. It should facilitate, you know, both large load interconnections, data centers, but it will also allow for more renewable integration. I think another example is cooperation across systems. There's been a recent announcement around the Northeast States Collaborative on Interregional Transmission. When you think about PJM, New York, New England, the opportunity to tighten the bonds between those three systems, cooperate on offshore wind. The reality is there's, you know, opportunities to develop, you know, more renewables in certain areas of that region than there are in others. And to the extent that you can interconnect those systems more effectively, you can come to better outcomes. One other lens on it is cooperation across utilities to ensure supply chain is built out. You know, so how do they think about spec alignment? How do they think about coordinated buying on the transmission side in order to ensure that, you know, the suppliers really have the right signals to provide what's required? So I would say that you see a lot of movement, particularly around transformation of generation portfolio, you know, contemplation of the future of gas, and then continued advancement in transmission planning, cooperation across ISOs. So a lot of fronts that they're pushing sustainability.
Well, that's an excellent roundup of all the levers that utilities can pull to prioritize sustainability in their own operations. But I would submit that they also have a lever to pull when it comes to ratepayers. You know, so what are some of the innovative examples of how utilities are conveying the message of sustainability to ratepayers?
Well, there's a number of fronts where utilities are harnessing the capabilities of customers to contribute to solutions here. I would say that when you think about behind the meter resources, there's a fairly clear path as it relates to FERC Order 2222. So this is the FERC regulations that basically require utilities to allow for participation in wholesale markets of behind the meter resources. So virtual power plants that utilize behind the meter storage and generation in order to play into capacity markets. So this is one place where utilities have somewhat of a forcing function in order to contribute to how customers can contribute to sustainability. You know, I would say that beyond that, you know, they're looking to broader distribution system operation capabilities. So looking beyond just VPP participation in wholesale, but really incentivizing customers to bring their own resources to contribute to grid stability. So, you know, when you think about voltage fluctuation, the opportunity to utilize behind the meter resources like storage in order to deliver non-wires alternatives, which should help with affordability in the long term. So, you know, behind the meter resources, there's a pathway that's defined for how they can participate both in wholesale markets and also in grid stability. When you look more broadly at demand side management, I think that we're beginning a pivot where, you know, historically some of these energy efficiency programs have been fairly static, very focused on, you know, meeting a very specific load reduction target in order to achieve a fairly well-defined incentive. You know, we're moving beyond that. You know, we're really thinking creatively about peak load shifting, demand response. So you're starting to see some innovative programs as it relates to EVs and their time of charging, you know, some cases with managed charging and some cases with utilizing those resources in the grid more broadly. You also have, I think, a move to, you know, to more effectively incorporate demand response. So, you know, there's always been leaders on this front. You got companies like Duke that have, you know, have a well-established demand response program for both residential and commercial and industrial customers. A very well-defined and easy to understand incentive for Duke that's led to real growth in their demand response resources. My sense is that that's going to be required. And so, you know, state regulators and utilities are going to have to become more creative in how they roll those out.
Well, listen, Chris, it certainly sounds like utilities have a rapidly evolving landscape to navigate. And I appreciate you coming on the show to describe that for us and explain some of the tactics that are being deployed. So thank you a lot for your time today.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that's our show for today. To our listeners, if you want to learn more about how you can leverage sustainability as a strategy, be sure to check out the library of episodes for this podcast.